If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
Kelly Leonard is in our studio. He is the Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development over at The Second City. He's the host of the Getting to Yes And podcast, which you can hear at WGNradio.com or wherever you hear podcasts. Getting to Yes And is a not brand new idea, but for those who don't know what the thrust of that is, what is that, Kelly?
So in improv comedy, one of the major rules is that if you're making something out of nothing with other people, you get nowhere by saying no. And you actually don't get that far by saying yes. We say you say yes and. You affirm and add in order to make transformational discoveries. And this is an idea that's really important when people are making something out of nothing together, early stage brainstorms, putting together a Second City review. And I often get the question from other people like, well, what about no? Don't you say no at times?
And lo and behold, now here's Dr. Sunita Saw, whose new book is called Defy the Power of No in a World That Demands Yes. And you put her on the Yes And podcast.
Yeah, I thought let's start the year with something a little bit different. And look, you know, I work with a lot of behavioral scientists, and we've done work at the University of Chicago and elsewhere. And so any study of no, I'm like, okay, yeah, when is the proper time to say no? And she starts the book with a personal story. Because Sunita, before she was an organizational psychologist at Cornell, she was a medical doctor in London. And she tells the story of having some chest pains and going to the ER. And immediately, the nurse who's seeing her doesn't even like look at her, just says, we want you to get a CT scan. And she knew why they wanted the CT scan. I won't go into the medical jargon, but she didn't need it. And but she let them do it. And she was reflecting on, like, why did I do this? And she says, I didn't want the scan. I didn't need the scan. But I also didn't want the medical team to think I didn't trust their judgment. And she started researching this idea of, like, why do we say yes when we should say no? And our societies are not set up for defiance. No one is teaching our kids, and I think you understand why in some regards, that they should be saying no at certain points. But then we live in a life all, you know, many, many times where no is absolutely the right thing to do. There's often a social penalty for saying no, right? If I say, can you do me a favor? And you respond like, no, I'm like, well, you're a jerk. Your boss asks you to do something. You think it's a bad idea. You say no. You're probably getting in trouble.
Yeah.
Your spouse asks you to do something you don't want to do. You're going to get in trouble. And that's from childhood, and especially with Sunita, who grew up in England, but with parents of Indian descent who wanted her to be a doctor when she really wanted to be a medical doctor, when she really wanted to be a psychologist, which she ended up doing. And that becomes her yes and story on the podcast. So it's an interesting concept around no.
Yeah, right. And in some cultures, it seems like the penalty for saying no, maybe Japan or China, maybe India, is maybe even greater than it is in the United States. Or did you or she discuss the cultural bias?
We don't go into huge detail, but I have a story about that because for, I don't know, like 6-7 years, we worked with Yoshimoto, which is the big entertainment conglomerate in Japan. And there is an organization in Chicago that offers free advice to companies working with folks in Japan. And I remember this distinctly, and it became true, which is in business dealings in Japan, you will never hear no, even if you're getting a no. You just have to figure it out.
Yeah.
And there was a point towards the end when our contract was clearly not going to be renewed, where no one said it wasn't going to be renewed, and no one said no. We're like, okay, we need to understand that there's a no there.
Right, right, right. And it would have helped everybody to just say it. But there's, I think there are two different kinds of no's, though. One is where no is an appropriate answer because I don't like it, I don't want it, I can't do it, I don't know. There are other times where it is because I just don't want to. Maybe I could, maybe I should, but I don't want to. I think that's where the penalty is.
Yeah, and I think the tricky thing is when the no's come in groups. So she has a thing she does, like an exercise she runs in her class at Cornell. So this is for like business students at Cornell. And she says, imagine you're part of a team of engineers and you're trying to break the land speed record in a rocket-propelled vehicle. And they call this vehicle Firefly. The team has been working on this for years. There's massive media attention. And oh, your team is competing with a different team that thinks their vehicle is the best. And there's a $10 million prize for whoever wins. Everything's going fine, but then there's one problem. On occasion, the Firefly's fuel line leaked during a test run. Not every time, but sometimes. And just before the final pre-race meeting, you share your concerns with the management team. So the lead manager who's instructed to do this sighs and says, okay, one by one, we're going to take a vote. Should we do the race or not? And invariably, and she says this is really, really predictable, the one person who is the dissenter ends up voting yes because everyone else votes yes. So the lesson of that, when they look at the data and they figure out they shouldn't have run, that really what this is the same thing that happened with the Challenger space shuttle.
Really?
Yeah. Remember that story?
Well, absolutely. The O-ring.
The O-ring. So they had engineers saying, we probably shouldn't do this, but they didn't have the data at that point to completely say for sure. And then the management people are looking like we're on the run. There's cameras here and all that. And they said yes, and they should have said no.
I think in that instance, if you're the person who still votes yes, even though you said no, you sort of are telling yourself, I want them to hear this. And then I'll still vote with them, but you can't say I didn't warn you, you know?
Yeah, she has a little line in the book. She says, when we hear the little voice in our head saying, this isn't me, it's a good idea to listen.
Say that again.
When we hear the little voice in our head saying, this isn't me, it's a good idea to listen. So when you're like I know this is a no, I need to say it.
Yeah, right.
That's the time you do it.
And why don't we say no under those circumstances?
Well, okay, social pressure is one, of course. But we talk about this also culturally. The no's in our culture seem to be reserved for heroes, right? People who have some sort of magic quality that just happened. And she tells a story in the book, and it reminded me of something that I remember, and I don't tell this story very often, and I don't know why I don't. My wife reminded me about it, but many years ago, we had a theater in Detroit. I don't know if you remember this. We were there for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. Our partners were the Illich family, so Mike and Marion Illich. They owned the Tigers and the Red Wings and Little Caesars Pizza, and they did a lot of great charity work as well. And they had an apartment complex that we would stay in as the theater was getting built. And I'm an early riser, and there was a diner on the first floor, and I would go to this diner in the morning, and there was always this very elderly African-American woman who would get there at the same time, and I'd hold the door for her. I did like 3 days in a row. And it's a Friday, and I'm going to go back that night, and I'm holding the door for her, and we both end up sitting at the counter, like everything else was filled. And we start chatting, and she's asking me about who I am and what I do. And I was like, my name's Kelly. And gradually I go, well, what's your name? And she goes, my name's Rosa. And we're talking a little bit more. It was Rosa Parks. Right. And I'm just flabbergasted. And I don't.
How old would Rosa Parks be at that time?
Oh, 80s? Yeah, something like that. And the Illich family had given her free residence when she moved back to Detroit.
How about that?
Years earlier. And I didn't know this. And we have this conversation. The reason this comes up in the book is because the story of Rosa Parks that we grew up with is this story of like this tired woman sitting in the bus, finally has had it. And says, I'm not getting up. And that's not the case at all. She was an activist. This was planned. She had years and years and years of practicing her no's. But for us, culturally, it makes more sense for it to be like, well, you know, she finally had it. That's this big story, this epiphany. And the thing is, if you want to get good at no, you have to really figure out how to do it well over a period of time, because, you know, think about our professional careers and the amount of times we were in those tricky situations when we know we have to negotiate a no, and it's not, maybe you just say it and it's going to get you in trouble, and then other times you find different ways to say it. It's hard. It really takes practice. It's not easy.
I feel that I say yes too often, and then that becomes a burden for me.
Sure.
But I feel like I can bear that burden, and that would be the better calling. That would be the better thing to do. So, but then the upshot of that is that then I either end up not doing it anyway or not doing it as well or not doing it in a timely fashion because it's burdensome because I don't want to do it. I should have said no. so often people will send me books or reach out to me personally or via email, and they want to come on the show, and they've got a really good idea and they've got a really good story, and I don't want to do it or I can't do it. There's a number of reasons I should say no, but I hate to disqualify their work. And by my saying, no, it's not good enough or I'm not interested, that seems almost inconsiderate. So I just work myself into a box on these things.
That's funny. I've gotten so much better at saying no with this stuff over time. She talks about the fact that you really should examine what your values are, and your values will tell you when you want to say no. And I would suggest a guest, whether it's on your show or my podcast, us saying no is not a violation of any value we actually care about.
It's not a violation of any value we care about. Yeah, I don't know how that answers my question of I feel bad telling them that I've just said you're not good enough or I'm not interested, which I should be able to say, Kelly.
Yes, you should.
I'm a big boy. This is the real world. And they are, too. I'm sure they'll manage. Kelly Leonard is the Vice President of Creative Strategy over at the Second City. He does that Getting to Yes and podcast, which is almost always a conversation with a thought leader in the sort of business psychology world.
Yeah.
Would you say that?
Yeah.
And you've always applied the tools that great improv players use. You've applied those to the business world and to everyday life as well. So you've also got a conversation coming up with Kurt Gray. Who is he and what did he do?
So he's a social psychologist who has a book called Outraged, Why We Fight About Morality and Politics and How to Find Common Ground. So kind of a topic that is present in our everyday
life. So that's a 4-page book?
It's like a 500-page book.
Can't be done.
I also interviewed him the day after Brian Thompson was shot, the CEO of UnitedHealthcare.
Oh, yeah, right.
And what I was seeing on my social media feeds was so disheartening that day, because people on the left are saying outrageous things, people on the right are saying outrageous things, and I don't know why we don't live in a world where we would be sad anytime any human being was hurt in any way. And this is very relevant to Kurt's research, because he writes in the book, the argument of this book is simple. We have a harm-based moral mind. Our evolutionary past makes us worry about harm, but people today disagree about which threats are the most important or most real, creating moral outrage and political disagreement. So that's not, I mean, if you look at the literature about the differences between the right and the left and why people think this way, this is a new theory that it's our brains, and our brains are harm-based. And this goes back to like sociology and anthropology, because he says that for years, people saw humans as predators because we were kind of in charge. But long before we were predators, we were prey. So evolutionarily, the reason we can stand in that is so we can look farther for the harm that's coming our way. And so he says this drives everything that we respond to. The other thing that's ironic about all this is we've never been safer.
Yeah, really.
And there's a really interesting in the book called the Tocqueville Paradox. As societies get less unjust, people demand even more justice. So I see this playing out all the time at Second City, and I hear it from my wife Anne and her college students, which is they're demanding more and more of more things that are more fair, things that are more just, and you know, which is very different than the world we necessarily grew up in. And you're like, well, how can this be? Because things are so just. And what Kirk Gray says is that's exactly why. So when things are more just, people demand things be more just. And this just plays out in different ways on the right and the left. And he's a fascinating interview. And I just think this is when you can understand that the person across from you that you disagree with, when you can look at them and go, okay, what's hurting you? You know, what is the harm that you feel? You have a chance at maybe getting through a dialogue. It's not easy. But he says overwhelmingly the response, the solution is storytelling. People's harm stories. Not when they're trying to convince us. But when you can share with someone your human story of harm that's happened to you, a bridge can be built.
But you make it sound as though when you challenge them, what's the harm to you, they might be unable to come up with a concrete example of how this thing we disagree about is harmful to me, and therefore you win the argument. You maybe persuade them. Is that not what you're saying?
I don't think so. I think when you tell people, you know, what are you afraid of?
Yeah.
They're going to tell you.
Okay, but I don't know if this is what we're talking about. But
yeah.
Let's talk about immigration for a second. Sure. Now, a lot of people are happy to deport people and don't want any more people coming in. And I understand a lot of that. But I haven't had anybody tell me how it's harmful to them, how these people or these policies are harmful to them.
Well, if you read a certain kind of media, it's because they're all criminals.
Yeah, but I mean, oh, really? Were you mugged? Were you robbed?
Oh, no, it doesn't matter if it's not true.
No, okay, but I mean, but I'm saying, but it's not personal either. I mean, yeah, look, it's terrible what happened to that lady in California. Those migrants did terrible things. But what about you? Were you harmed? Where's the harm to you, right?
Yeah, well, I think that you know, it depends. How did you grow up? What was the fear of your parents? What's your fear? Why do you lock the doors? I think about this all the time in terms of locking the doors. You and I are kind of in the same neighborhood. And it's not like there's not crime there. But the level at which I lock my door or look at it like, oh, someone could get in here, you know, or not get in here is interesting. But I don't come from a harm-based thing where I'm actually worried about that. That's not my primary concern.
Yeah.
Probably because I grew up in a fair amount of privilege.
Yeah.
They didn't have to worry about that. So it's just sort of getting to what's the underlying thing you think, the way you think. And why do you think that way?
Yeah, but now what's the purpose of that? So if you and I are we disagreeing about something, and I'm engaging in conversation, is that what we're doing?
So this is a classic thing that Second City teaches. So often we're brought into companies, and they're like, "Look, our younger employees don't know how to talk to our older employees," and then there's generational differences or the other kind of differences, and so we have all kinds of exercises that allow people to experience what we call generous listening. Be generous in your listening. Really listen to the full. Listen to the end of sentences. We have a specific exercise that is all about you just listening to the end of a sentence and then trying to understand what that person is saying and what are they not saying. You know, and when you put yourself in this idea of replacing a kind of a blame attitude with a curious attitude, you might find points of connection that allow each other to work together.
Why we fight about morality and politics and how to find common ground. I wish that waiting to the end of a sentence would have been practiced by members of the Senate Defense Committee, the Armed Services Committee that was vetting Pete Hegseth yesterday, because maybe this isn't the same thing, but so often they would cut him off because he was vacillating a little bit or not giving them an answer they wanted. And I'm no fan of Pete Hegseth, but I also get frustrated with the way those things are conducted.
Yeah, it didn't seem like anyone was trying to have a productive conversation.
It wasn't a real vetting of the guy.
No,
it
no.
was just a stating opinions. Nobody was listening.
This is the number one thing that people say to me when I talk about this and that, you know, I do talks around, which is, are you doing any work in government? Can you please go help the government?
Really? What's your answer to that?
I'll try. do they
hey,
have a
government,
check?
call Kelly Leonard. He is the vice. I'm not kidding. He's the vice president of creative strategy, innovation, and business development at the Second City. He's the host of Getting to Yes And. It's a podcast you'll find everywhere, including WGNRadio.com. And his latest conversations are about defying the power of no in a world that demands yes. And this book by Kurt Gray. Thanks for coming in, Kelly.
Thanks, John.